This podcast is brought to you by MyBookie. Are you the type of fan that knows football so well that you could choose any game and call it? Well, MyBookie is the place for you because they let you turn all your sports knowledge into cash in your wallet. Between football season, NBA, and the start of college basketball season, it's time to get off the sideline and get in on the action with MyBookie. If you're the kind of guy who likes to bet a little to win a lot, try a parlay. For instance, if you like a couple of the big favorites this week, parlays are perfect because they let you bet multiple games together for a much bigger payout. So if you're going to bet this season, do the smart thing and go to mybookie.ag because no one gives you more ways to win. Tired of watching the games from the couch with nothing to gain? MyBookie wants to get your mind off everything else and back on the game. If you join right now, MyBookie will match your deposit halfway, all the way up to $1,000. That means if you deposit $2,000, you get an extra $1,000 in free money to play with. Just use promo code MENACE to activate the offer. Once again, that's promo code MENACE to take advantage of MyBookie's generous sign-up offer. Visit MyBookie.ag today. You play, you win, you get paid. It is Thursday, November 5th. 20 days until Santa Claus comes. Happy holidays and favorite time of year, man. I hope you guys are enjoying prepping for gift giving and all the blessings that come. And I do want to mention one thing. I saw this post on Facebook. I don't know who posted it. It doesn't matter. But it's so true. I think about my childhood and I'm thinking about, you know, obviously I'm in a very different place this year than I have been other years when it comes to Christmas and Santa Claus. And I do want to reminisce with you and take you back to your childhood because it's the memories that count. I have a 9-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 2-year-old. And I've been like, man, what am I going to get them for Christmas? I got to make sure they have a great Christmas. And the reality is they're not going to remember what I get them for Christmas. They're going to remember waking up at my house Christmas morning and the smell of breakfast, all the family that comes over and all the great times, the fun we have. So I just wanted, I don't know, I needed to hear it. I saw it on Facebook. So with as many listeners as this show has, I just wanted to kind of remind you, this holiday season is about experiences and what you and your family get to do together and the memories you make, not about the gifts. Though it is awesome to give gifts and bring people joy, just remember, it's about the time, man. Time is the greatest gift of all. So I don't know. I just felt like sharing that because it impacted me and I needed to hear it. So I wanted to pass it on. But really excited about this episode. We have a number of things to talk about. A lot of current events to talk about, more so than usual. Also going to break down the Iron Bowl and something that Gus Malzahn did that really struck a chord with me. I want to talk about kind of the operation of a defensive staff and how they decide what defense to call. And because obviously there was a major blunder by Alabama at the end of the game to lose the game. So I'm going to really talk about the Iron Bowl, but also talk about just college football and give you a little perspective into how defenses operate, because I think it's something that you guys would enjoy. And I also definitely want to talk about some dumbass announcers of the week. And I also want to talk about some conference breakdowns as we get into the championship analysis coming tomorrow on Friday. So really excited, man. Let's get to the show.
That's why I don't read the newspaper, because it's garbage. And the editor that let it come out is garbage.
Or do you do what everybody else in the media does, just create some shit and throw it on the wall and see what sticks, which is what I see happening everywhere.
Where are we at in society today? I'm a man. I'm 40.
When my time on earth is gone and my activities here are past, I want they bury me upside down and my critics can kiss my
All right, welcome to episode 53 here on November 5th. Thank you for tuning in. I do want to mention, apologize that we didn't have an episode on Tuesday. We usually put out 4 a week. We're probably going to get to do 3 a week, 3 this week. And we're going to restructure kind of the frequency moving forward after the championship games. But I was sick as a dog for 2 days, 48 hours. I mean, the Tuesday, I almost couldn't function. So I actually tried to record on Tuesday. I should put it out. It's like a blooper reel. It sounds awful. So I didn't want to put you through that pain. I figured I'd wait a day or two, get better, get my voice back, and then bring you the content that we like to put out. Quality content. That's the key, right? So really excited about it. But let's start this thing off. I want to start this thing off because I heard a speech from Texas Tech's basketball coach, Chris Beard, that I think everyone, And I'm not talking just, this is very applicable to athletes. So if you have an athlete, you have a kid, you have a nephew, a cousin, someone that is an athlete, this could not be a better example of how to handle adversity and how to operate as an athlete. But also I'm sitting here listening to it and thinking, how do I apply this to life? So he makes some unbelievable points. It is spot on. And I had to share it with you. So here is Texas Tech's Chris Beard after the game, whatever, a couple days ago.
When you have that type of adversity and you lose a couple in a row, do you approach it differently with a young team than you would maybe a more experienced team who's been through stretches like that before?
No, we stay the course, process, get up, make sure you win today, go to class, sit on the first couple rows, take your hat off, turn your cell phone off, listen to the teacher, take notes, get in the training room, take care of your body, make sure you eat 4 or 5 meals like a champion, stay away from the dollar menu, go eat something that has some color in it. Tell the Coca-Cola later and drink the water or milk. Get in the video room and watch it and take hard coaching and be a man. Get to practice and get loose and embrace the practice. Come back at night and get your shots up. Be a great teammate. Get in the weight room. It's the process. It's what you do. And then you stay after it. You know, wins, games. I mean, we work at this thing about 362 days a year. And you get 31 games. I mean, it's not just about the game. It's about the process. You earn the right to play in games. We just got to keep fighting.
I wanted to play that for you because it's so true. I'm not even going to claim that I have any idea what Texas Tech's going through in basketball. Obviously, they faced some adversity, lost some games. But it's so relevant to athletes. I mean, how you handle a loss, how you handle a setback, an injury, anything. And I just think about my path the last 18 months. And, you know, I go from this successful college football coach with a bright future, probably a lot of positivity happening, you know, in the near future, to everything falls and just crumbles. And I think about it, and it's like for about probably 3 months, it was about, July 23rd until about October, like Halloween time, where I was just an absolute bitch about it. I mean, just like depressed, miserable, and I'm not discounting people that go through those emotions, but at some point it was like, you know what? What are you going to do about it? Shut the fuck up and get back to work. And that's what I told myself, and that's just so relevant. It's like, what are you going to do? You lost some games. You're going to change what you do. You're going to change who you are. You're going to go complain about it. What's that going to accomplish? So I just wanted to share that with you because I think it's so relevant. It's just shut up and get back to work. Do what you do. Handle yourself like the person you want to be. I was told a long time ago, dress for the job you want, not the job you have. And that's a metaphor. It does apply to how you dress and your appearance, but it's also a metaphor to how you act. If you act like a CEO, you might one day become the CEO. If you act like the low-level employee, you will never become the CEO. Simple as that. So I had a decision to make a little over a year ago of what did I want to do? Did I want to complain and forever be known as the coach that got fired from Ohio State? Or did I want to start a new path, start a new journey, kind of get back on the horse and just shut the fuck up and go to work? So that's what I decided to do. But anyway, some current events. Some coaches have been hired. How about Bob Stoops back in it? Back in the coaching world, Florida State head coach Bob Stoops. That is, I was surprised. I didn't think he would do it, but I know Florida State fans, that was all they wanted. So it's a great hire for them. I mean, they should be able to get back to some form of relevancy, and that should help in recruiting a lot. And then also Jim McElwain, bizarre hire. Missouri hires Jim McElwain. I don't know if people remember how he did at Florida, but it was, I mean, horrendous. Then he went to Michigan, had a couple stints, a couple stops, and then is now the head coach of Missouri, I guess. But I just wanted to mention those. Now, the one thing that is just shocking to me, and I don't want to keep harping on this program, but I just want to talk about this general situation. So Texas has obviously fired a bunch of coaches. We talked about it on the first episode earlier in the week, I think Monday. And they're in the coaching search. They need a defensive coordinator and a new offensive coordinator because they retained Tim Beck because he's has a great relationship with Bijan Robinson and the lead recruiter, and they don't want to lose the running back recruit. So they had to keep Tim Beck on. I would be interested to see if that continues past signing day, if Bijan signs. But either way, they're looking for an offensive coordinator. And so the rumor out there is they're going to go for Joe Brady. And if Joe Brady were to leave LSU, I would be shocked. Really shocked to go from a program that is going to in the hunt for a national title on the rise to go to Texas, a program that he legitimately could be fired in a year. You got to make those. I mean, you really have to think about that as a coach. Are you want to jump on a sinking ship? Even and granted, it's high risk, high reward. If he can turn that offense around and have an offense like he has at LSU right now, he'll get any head coaching job in the country. But it's risky because you're working for an offensive head coach. And so will you really have the reins to the offense and the control to do what you want? It's kind of like Josh Gattis at Michigan. Does he really have the reins on that offense, or is Jim Harbaugh hindering his ability to run the offense? But that's not what I wanted to talk about. The other person, the more likely hire, is USC's Graham Harrell. Now, here's what I want to talk about. Graham Harrell's an air raid guy, an air raid offense coach, right? It's vastly different from Tom Herman's kind of single wing spread offense philosophy. And here's the relevancy and why that matters. Not that Graham Harrell couldn't do a great job at Texas. I don't think they have the personnel for the air raid offense right now. I don't think Sam Ellinger is an air raid type of quarterback at all. But here's when you know things are in a bad place in any program. When you have a head coach, a la Tom Herman, an offensive guru, that was his come up, that was his rise. When he goes vastly outside of his own offensive philosophy with a coordinator, that is wildly concerning. It rarely ever happens. And when it does, it is like there's going to be one, it is a complete dissension from his own beliefs that got him to Texas, his lifelong career. That would be very, very hard for him to part with if they just full on switch. And I think back to the 10 years at Florida with like Will Muschamp, where there was like every year or two, there was a new coordinator that we went from like Charlie Weiss. They brought the guy in from Boise State. So they went from Charlie Weiss's offense to a 12 personnel offense to, and they're all over the map bouncing back and forth. And it's like, you have no offensive identity or beliefs. And that can be very dangerous. That it also is concerning because if things go even, if there's slight struggles, Tom Herman will interject himself and then try to shift it back to his own beliefs. And it's just, you talk about a very, very mal-aligned, philosophy. If you bring in someone that is vastly different from yourself, it would be like Mike Leach right now. Let's say he had to make changes, fired his offensive staff, and had to bring in a new OC, and he hired Paul Johnson to run the triple option. That's what it would be like. Can you imagine how that would go? It would be very, very bad. It would also be like I think about Corder's defensive guru, like Chris Ash, who's going to be named the defensive coordinator at Texas. You can write it down. He's already taken the job. They'll announce it after the bowl game. Chris Ash, new DC at Texas. He's a Corder's guy, Corder's guru, phenomenal coordinator, phenomenal coach. He'll do great things at Texas. But it would be like Chris Ash getting a head coaching job, like when he was at Rutgers, and going out and hiring Greg Madison to run cover three. It just doesn't happen. One, because as a defensive coach or an offensive coach, and you rise to that head coach level at the big time college football, you have a number of disciples that obviously helped you get there and that are excellent football coaches. And you mean to tell me you can't find one that has similar beliefs to yourself that can be a productive and quality coordinator for you? What happened to them all? Did you Hillary Clinton them all? Drew Maringer was your protege. Well, you fired him. Tom and I were very close. Oh, okay, get me fired. Try to ruin my life. And there's several more. Where are Tom Herman's disciples at? And on a broader picture, when you see programs make those kinds of changes, just drastic switches. Now, I'm not talking about Nick Saban. Nick Saban's a defensive coach. He may hire different styles of offensive coordinators because it's not his core beliefs. He just wants an offense that works, that is effective, and that helps his defense. So just very bizarre thing going on at Texas. And I wanted to talk about that from an insider's perspective into the industry, because you talk about red flags, red alert. If there was not enough alerts into how bad Texas is trending, this is even worse if they go out and hire Graham Harrell. Also, other news, all conference teams came out, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but I just want to mention one thing. Ohio State, first time in the history of the Big Ten, had a full-on sweep. Offensive, defensive players of the year and coach of the year, first since my grandfather, which, I mean, honestly, you go through the history of Ohio State and like the fact that no one ever won coach of the year. I mean, Jim Tressel or Urban Meyer never won coach of the year since 1979. It's bizarre. But anyway, everyone bitches about that. I don't want to talk about it for too long. But full-on sweep. It shows how dominant Ohio State has been, at least in the Big Ten, if nothing else. Chase Young, Defensive Player of the Year. Justin Fields, Offensive Player of the Year. And Ryan Day, Coach of the Year. So congratulations to Ryan. He's, I mean, obviously well-deserved. But more important than that, how about this? The quarterback of the year in the Big Ten, this is a fairly new award, the Defensive Lineman Award, and I heard James Laurinaitis talking about it, Linebacker of the Year Award, and things like that. Like, who's the best quarterback in the Big Ten? So it's the Big Ten Greasy Breeze quarterback of the year was Justin Fields. It's been around for 9 seasons. Ohio State has won 7 out of the 9. That is astounding for the conference as a whole, and why Ohio State is on another level, and really the only program that is relevant in a national landscape. Year in, year out. Even when Ohio State goes 10-2, they're still relevant. No one else is relevant. A team has snuck in here and there with I mean, no success on the national landscape. But really interesting to see just, I guess, the how far ahead Ohio State is. It's insane. But now it's time for my favorite segment, new segment that we've had now for a couple weeks. Is the dumbass sports media personality. We'll call it that. The DASMP, dumbass sports media personality of the week. We have two contestants. And the first one is actually someone that I really like. And I think is he's one of the most successful sports media personalities. He's one of the best, but he did something that really he had no spine when he did this. It is our dear friend, Mike Greenberg from, of course, they're both ESPN. Someone send me one from another network. I haven't been able to find one, but the ESPN sure has a litany of them. Mike Greenberg, I want you to hear what he had to say. Keep in mind, he predicted Michigan would beat Ohio State. So let's hear his, I guess, post-game analysis of the game that he predicted Michigan would win. Here he is right in here, Mike Greenberg.
I'm about to say something that is going to make a bunch of people mad because it is true, and nothing hurts quite like the truth, and here it comes. Jim Harbaugh is being belittled, criticized, and diminished because of a false perception about the program that he leads, which is to say the University of Michigan is not, and has not, for a very long time, been among the truly elite football programs in America. That was true before Harbaugh arrived, it is true today, and it will probably be true long after he leaves. Did you know the last time Michigan won an outright national championship in football was 1948? Do you know how many titles they've shared since then? One. Do you know how many national titles the legendary Bo Schembechler won at Michigan? Zero. Do you know the last time they won the Big Ten was 15 years ago? Ohio State has won it 9 times since then. Those are facts, and Jim Harbaugh has almost nothing to do with them. Here is the reality. The two coaches who preceded Harbaugh at Michigan, Rich Rodriguez and Brady Hoke, went 24-32 in the conference. Harbaugh is 32-12. He's won 80% of his games against everyone but Ohio State, and therein lies the rub. You want to make this all about Ohio State, but that is not a good idea, because a hammer and a nail have a relationship, but not a rivalry, and that's what this is. Ohio State had beaten Michigan 10 of 11 years before Harbaugh came to town. The only Ohio State team to lose to Michigan since 2003 was coached by Luke Fickell. So perhaps I should just leave this with you in the form of a question. Is the problem right now in Ann Arbor the coach, or is it the expectations?
Oh, Michael, you can't do that. You can't do that, you flip-flopping son of a bitch. First of all, let me say this. As with most of his takes, I don't disagree with a single thing he said. However, he was the one predicting a Michigan win before the game. You don't get to do that, Mikey. You got to stay true to what you say. For instance, let me teach you. I said before the year PJ Fleck was a used car salesman and was not a great head coach. I was wrong. He's had a phenomenal year. I do think he's a used car salesman, but guess what? People are buying the damn car. I admitted I was wrong, and he proved me wrong. That's what you do. Did you see that, what I did right there? I held myself accountable for one of my opinions that was wrong. You should try it sometime. And here's the other part that you fail to mention. You talk about dramatic. First, Michigan's going to win. Now they're never been relevant. Here's the problem. They have been far more nationally relevant than you want to give them credit for, Mike Greenberg. Now, have they won it all? No, of course not. We all know that. But they have been relevant in somewhat recent history. I mean, not going back too far. You talk about in the last 15, 20 years, they've been relevant. They've been ranked in the top 5. I vividly remember in 2006 when I was at Florida that people were demanding that Michigan play Ohio State in a rematch because Florida wasn't good enough. Now, obviously, that wasn't true, but they were relevant. And that's why you pay a man $7.5 million to at least get them back to 2006 when they were at least in the goddamn conversation. But they were relevant. They would have made the playoffs several times in the last 20 years if there was a top four playoff. But Harbaugh hasn't had them close. Blunder after blunder. Obviously can't beat Ohio State, but even outside of that, hasn't even been to Indianapolis, but they've been to freaking Rome and Africa. And what's next this year? I bet you the AD this year says, no, you could go to how about Windsor? Windsor's a good spot to go take the team on a little trip. The budget's running out on you, Jimmy. But anyways, you can't do that or else you get put on the dumbass announcer of the week. Now, our second contestant, my favorite, he could be a reoccurring guest on the show from a clip. I'm never going to have him on the show. Unless he wanted to. My God, you talk about a debate. I would love to debate Mr. Paul Feinbaum. I want you to hear what Paul Feinbaum had to say. And I'm going to talk about Dabo Swinney and what he said because Dabo is not wrong. Just so we're very clear, he is not wrong. Now, he's playing a little victim role, but he's not wrong. But here was Paul Feinbaum responding to Dabo Swinney's talk about how people view Clemson. Here we go, Paul. Let's hear it.
I think Dabo Swinney is the most annoying winner in all of sports. I mean, the guy just can't keep his trap shut. I mean, somebody just give the man a pacifier, send him to timeout, and we'll check in with him on December 28th when he finally plays a legitimate team during this entire college football season.
Well, now, Paulie, if that isn't the pot calling the kettle black, I don't know what is. Dabo Swinney is annoying and needs a pacifier? Bitch, have you listened to yourself or looked in the mirror? The most annoying media personality in sports is you, Paul. I can't listen to you. I don't know how people listen to you. Not only are your takes horrendous, are you annoying? Not only all of that, not only do you have no knowledge of the sport that you're analyzing and discussing, but it is so hard to understand your with Nick Saban and Alabama's dick in your mouth, Paul. Get the fuck out of here with your never played a snap of football in your life and look like you can probably hear this podcast from Alabama without even tuning in. You're a dumbass. You have horrible takes and you literally, and I get it. I get the whole, it's a brand. People, it's like Stephen A. Smith. Stephen A. Smith's one of the highest paid analysts in the country. Why? Because people can't stand him. He's annoying. He yells a lot. He makes outrageous takes and pisses people off. I don't know why people like that, but I tend to tune out. But those are our two contestants for dumbass sports media personalities of the week. So here's what I want everyone to do. I want you to respond who you think it was this week. We're going to do a vote every week. The hashtag DASMP, dumbass sports media personality. Tell me who it is, Mike Greenberg or Paul Feinbaum this week. I'm really interested to hear what you all have to say. But we're going to take a quick break, one of our sponsors, and then I really want to talk about Dabo Swinney, what he said about Clemson, and then really want to get into some conference discussions and talk about this Iron Bowl, because we might start off with the Iron Bowl. I think we'll start off with the Iron Bowl right back after this. Are you tired of paying your bookie every weekend because your lock of the week is as reliable as a Jim Harbaugh game plan? What if you could leverage a data analytics group who has consistently predicted results for the last 4 years with a 60% documented success rate? The guys at PromAthletics.com have done just that and want you to get in on the action for free this week. Yep, for free. With 100% transparency, their model has resulted in them being the only handicapping group in the world to finish in the top 100 the last 3 years in the Las Vegas Super Contest, the globe's largest handicapping contest. I personally used their picks this weekend and went 7-1 in college football. I'm 18-5 overall using their college football platform for the last 3 weeks. Yeah, you heard me correct. 18-5. No joke, it's free money. I hit a 3-team parlay on Saturday. They want you to see the truth so bad that they are giving away a free week of all sports with code MENACE. Again, code MENACE gets you a 1-week VIP pass for free. No strings attached, no BS. Trust me and try it out. You literally have nothing to lose. If you want to sign up for the remainder of the season, you can use code MENACE50, the number 50, for 50% off any package. Don't let another losing weekend get the best of your wallet. Head to pro, as in P-R-O, mathletics.com to start winning today. All right, welcome back. Well, without further ado, I'm so excited to talk about this because I think I can provide some insight into not why Alabama lost, not why Auburn won, but how Gus Malzahn out-coached Nick Saban and called checkmate at the end of the game. So we're going to get to that in a minute. So first, it's analysis of the game. I thought, first of all, both defenses kind of showed their ass. And the SEC is the Big 12 of the country right now. And I don't care what anyone says. I don't want to hear that nonsense about the SEC's offenses are so good. That's why the defenses. No. These defenses are absolute garbage. I'm watching Auburn, supposedly this great defense, just let up 500-some yards and just get gashed. And don't get me wrong. Alabama has absolute explosions at every position on offense. Najee Harris, Jalen Waddle, Henry Ruggs, Jerry Jeudy. I mean, it's ridiculous. They have the best offensive skill in America, them and Clemson. But that defense was bad. But let's talk about it. So first one, missed tackles. Always got to start with missed tackles. Both teams, very impressive tackling. 5 missed tackles for Alabama, 5 missed tackles for Auburn. So a very, very impressive day. On defense, tackling wise, so that's a wash, right? You can't say one team lost because they couldn't tackle. Both teams protected their quarterbacks decent. I always look at that next: how teams run the ball and how they protect their quarterback. Both defenses had 8 total pressures, but here's why Auburn won the game. Outside of the end of the game, I want to get to that in a minute. But first of all, let's not sit here and act like Bo Nix played exceptional. And I will stand by my statements, and they're still true. I watched the film twice now, and Bo Nix will be a really good quarterback. He is not yet. He was 15 of 31. Now, granted, he had 3 drops. He had 171 yards and 1 touchdown. Here's the thing: 7 of those completions, 7 of 15 completions, almost half, were behind the line of scrimmage. Little push sweeps and screens and things like that behind the line of scrimmage. Meaning he went 8 of 22 when he threw it past the line of scrimmage. That 36% completion percentage. But he outplayed Mac Jones. People will say, Mac Jones completed 60% of his passes, blah, blah, blah. He threw for X amount of yards, to over 300 yards. Here's the thing. Mac Jones has the best offensive weapons at his disposal. And 11 of his completions were behind the line of scrimmage. They didn't ask him to do much, which was smart on their part because Tua's out and they didn't want to overwhelm him and ask him to be Tua. But he threw 2 interceptions, and that's why they lost the game. So he was 15 of 28 past the line of scrimmage, so more like 53%. Let's not act like he played well. Let's not be stat champions where we look at stats and say he played really well. He threw for 300 yards and completed 67% of his passes. No, he didn't. But the reality is this. If you're Mac Jones, he needed to be like Alabama quarterbacks of the past, right? Just don't turn the ball over and let your freakish players win the game. And we also can stop, like I mentioned, with the vaunted Auburn defense, 515 total yards. They had almost, Najee Harris, 150 yards rushing almost, almost five yards per rush, 8 of 16 on 3rd and 4th down. That's 50%. Do you know how high that is against a quote-unquote great defense? Now, I will say this, Jalen Waddle, wow. Watch out for him in the first round. He had a game, didn't he? He is one of the most dynamic players in the country. And why the trio of receivers, him, Jerry Jeudy, and Henry Ruggs, is the best in America. 7 touches for 230 yards and 2 touchdowns. Over 31 yards every time he touched the ball. But the reality is, Alabama killed themselves with penalties, 13 penalties, and the 2 interceptions. And then, here's what I want to really talk about. They got out-coached at the end. So here's the scenario. Alabama stops Auburn with 1:06 remaining, down by 3 on Auburn's 26. The reality is this. It is very viable that they're going to get the ball roughly, 40-yard net punt maybe. They'll get the ball about their own 35-yard line with 1 minute remaining. All they have to do is get to field goal range. So they need to get about 30 yards in 1 minute. You mean to tell me they can't get 30 yards in 1 minute with their skill? And Auburn is going to play a little, not prevent, but they're not going to probably go after Alabama and in fear of giving up a touchdown, another touchdown to Jalen Waddle or any of the litany of playmakers they have. And then Gus Malzahn called checkmate and outcoached the great Nick Saban. Here's what he did. And then I want to talk about why it worked, and how he did it. He subbed in a new personnel group. He put the punter in at wide receiver. And here's what happens. So that you understand, there's a defensive GA up in the box. All he does at the end of a play is look for personnel to tell the defensive coordinator what personnel group is on the field. So then that defensive coordinator can go to his chart and say, here's their personnel group. We've studied all week what they run when those players in the game, maybe two tight ends or one tight end, two running backs, one running back. It doesn't matter. Whatever conglomeration of positions they put on the field, they have a certain call sheet to try to stop what Alabama does when they put that personnel group on the field. So he is constantly saying, all right, that tight end ran out, that running back came in, now it's 20 personnel, which means two backs, zero tight ends. So now he sees this personnel group. He calls it out. Now the special teams GA is yelling out, the punter's on the field, punt, punt return, punt return, punt return. So they send the punt returner and punt return team on the field. Then they realize the quarterback's still on the field. Now they're going back and forth. So they try to get the punt return team off, get the defense back on. They get it done, except for one thing. The returner doesn't get the message relayed and doesn't get off the field because they put the punter in at receiver. It was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So they get an too many men on the field penalty, game, set, match. Gus Malzahn wins the Iron Bowl. And it was so interesting to me to talk about because I don't think people understand personnel, how offensive coaches can use that as a weapon. I think back to Arkansas, and let's see, it was 2006 when I was at Florida. They used to do a phenomenal job. They would have two tight ends and a running back on the field. They'd take all three of them off, run three tight ends on and another running back, and a receiver would come off. And it was just like constant math equations for the GA. Every play trying to figure out what personnel group they're in. And it completely messes with the defense because you have to have bigger personnel. And if they have bigger personnel, and you have to have maybe a nickelback or a dime personnel in, meaning six defensive backs, six faster guys, if they put four wide in the game and no tight ends. So there's so much. You have to match personnel. And if offenses use that to their advantage and as a weapon, they can run guys on and off the field and really create chaos for you on defense. And it made me think, like, that's one way defenses, that offenses mess with defenses. They mess with them with personnel. And Arkansas was one of the best at it because they had, back when they had Felix Jones and Darren McFadden and all these great players. And they were in the SEC championship game. That was probably the last time they were decent. But here's what I was thinking about, the three ways people mess with defenses. So that's one, personnel packages. One, because it creates confusion on what personnel is in. That's one way to do it with personnel. The other thing it does is it dictates the defensive call variety, meaning there's only a certain number of things that a defense will do with certain people on the field. Like, they won't ask a big linebacker to do the same thing they ask a smaller nickelback, defensive back. Like, when Ohio State put Sean Wade in, they're not asking him to do the same thing if Malik Harrison is the walkout or if whoever is the walkout. The other thing that they'll do is they'll align in unconventional personnel sets. Think about this. If you bring in two tight ends and a big running back, and then you only have two receivers, teams are expecting you to be in more of a loaded two tight end set. If you line up in empty, a lot of times you can create a mismatch with a lesser athlete in space. We used to do it all the time. And we didn't do it enough. I don't think teams do that enough. That can really mess with defenses. The other thing that we had at Ohio State when I was there and at Florida with guys like Percy Harvin and Jeff Demps and Chris Rainey is you can create a personnel group with other positions. Think about if you have Curtis Samuel in the game, what is he? If you're on defense, what is he? Is he a running back? Now you have a set of calls that you're going to call because you might have he and Mike Weber in the game at the same time, two running backs. Oh, now he's a slot receiver. Totally different calls. Creates confusion. How about if people remember Noah Brown, a bigger receiver at Ohio State, you put him in the game. Is he a receiver? He was a receiver. He played receiver, but he could certainly do what those movement tight ends did. So you can create a lot of confusion. The other thing that people do a lot of that is very in vogue, and it's starting to go out of vogue a little bit, but the no huddle offense. Why do teams do the no huddle offense? They do the no huddle offense for two reasons. One, to wear out a defense. It's a conditioning advantage, right? If you practice no huddle all the time and you become so efficient and so fast at it, the defense gets gassed. And the chaos, it's hard for them to simulate the speed at which your no huddle offense goes in practice with like scout team players. It's almost impossible. That's one reason. The other, and then the next thing it does, because they do those things and teams are having to get calls in faster and get lined up and there's so much chaos, it's a talent equalizer. It's a way to take a less talented team and try to even the playing field with a more talented team. That's a no huddle. The other thing that some teams do, this was a big Stanford deal back in the day, and teams still do it. It's I don't know why teams don't do more of it. It's called a quick huddle, where you line up in the huddle and you break the huddle, get to the line, and snap the ball as fast as possible, because there's no referee going to stand over the ball when you do that. And the defense has to see the formation, get lined up, and make their calls really fast. It creates confusion. It catches them off guard. It's also a way to align in unconventional sets, meaning normally you have the center, and then on each side, a guard, and then a tackle. So it's even. But if you line up in a huddle and explode as fast as you can to the line of scrimmage, and now both tackles are on the left, you've created an extra gap. And if you run it to the left, unless the defense sees it, gets lined up in about 3 seconds, they're going to be short a gap and you can gash them. So it just made me think, like, there's so many cool things that offenses can do to take the advantage from the defense. Because, you know, you don't know who's blitzing. You don't know what the coverage is going to be on offense. But you can take that power back into your own hands. And Gus Malzahn did that in this game. He called checkmate on Nick Saban. And it was phenomenal. So what an Iron Bowl. What an Iron Bowl. And what a win by Auburn. What a win for Gus Malzahn. And now Alabama is not in the playoffs. And the rest of the country rejoiced. So I wanted to talk about that game and really wanted to talk about how it happened, because I think it's I've watched everyone's talking about every other reason it happened. I wanted to talk about how it happened, how Gus Malzahn did that. I also wanted to talk about something. If you haven't heard it yet, the Pilot Boys podcast, Mecca, Don, and V, they've started this podcast, and I've been on it, I think, every episode now, as their kind of college football insider. And it's a great podcast. It's not just about sports, but definitely check it out if you want another good listen. But I kind of went on this because they asked me a question about all these excuses that Michigan made, and it made me think about it on a national landscape about Michigan's upset because Justin Fields takes online classes. And it is so funny because I don't know if anyone knows this, but when, like, my players took online classes all the time, and they were the biggest pain in the ass classes ever. They were harder. There was no personal connection. You couldn't see the teacher every day and develop a relationship. There was no way to maybe, you know, the teacher sees you're working really, really hard, and at the end of the year, you're 2 points shy of a B that you need. And so he lets you do an extra paper to kind of get those extra credit to get the B. There was none of that. It was simply, one, you had to stay personally accountable, handle your business, and get the work done. Otherwise, there was no one. You didn't have to show up to class, so there was no one that was going to hold, like, make sure you turned in your homework. You just had to do it. So online classes are not easy. Let's make no mistake about it. And the next thing is, the team that is calling it out is Michigan. I would challenge you this. Go through there. I bet they took it off their website. I should have looked, and I will. I'll do it for next week. I did a study, this is probably 2013 maybe, on Michigan, and over 70% of their team, maybe 65% of their team. You know what their study was, their major was? General studies. That was their degree. General studies. What the fuck are you going to do with a general studies degree? It's bad enough if you just get a sociology degree. Like, what are you going to do with that unless you're going to become a college professor? General studies. Yeah, okay. Justin Fields is taking online classes. He's also probably going to do some internships, build a network with the Real Life Wednesdays program. And there's other schools like that. Florida didn't really have a general studies degree. There was no, like, easy degree to put athletes in. So let's stop about the academic prowess of Michigan. It is a phenomenal school. The problem is the football team isn't taking those. They're not in the real school. They're going to general studies classes and going to how to succeed on campus classes and where to find the library classes. So let's stop with that. The second thing I heard was Ohio State cheats in recruiting. And it's like, what? I've recruited against everyone in the country. You can name a school I recruited against them at some point. Michigan doesn't even try to recruit national talent. I never recruited at Michigan one time, or recruited against Michigan one time. Not once. I mean, you could talk about Donovan Peoples-Jones. That doesn't count. One, he's in Detroit. Two, both of his parents graduated from Michigan. I'm talking about outside of Michigan. I cannot tell you one player I ever recruited against Michigan for. I never competed with him. How does that happen? How do you know if Ohio State's cheating if you don't even recruit against them outside of the state of Ohio and the state of Michigan? Some Midwest kids, that's about the only thing you are competing against Ohio State for. It's sad when teams make excuses, man. Excuses are like assholes. Everyone's got them. And Michigan has so many assholes right now. It's ridiculous. So before I close the show, I hope you enjoyed that analysis and defense. I never want to get too scheme oriented or X's and O's oriented, because I don't want to talk over people's heads and not to be conceited, but, let me know if you enjoy that stuff. I'd love to do more of it, but, and I want to make sure I'm provide some clarity. But anyways, Dabo Swinney is on a media crash or media, frenzy going after people that are looking down on Dabo. And I wanted to just kind of read a couple things that he said. I'm going to read this opening paragraph that he said. Dabo said to the media just, I think, earlier this week. He said, "It's the media. It's what drives everything. That doesn't mean there's bad people out there. I'm not chastising anyone. I just think other programs get the benefit of the doubt from time to time. And for whatever reason, our league, the ACC, and certainly Clemson, we don't get the benefit of the doubt. If there was another team out there coming off a 15-0 season, had beaten Alabama by 4 touchdowns, people should focus more on who we are, not who we so-called play. I could understand if we were a new kid on the block, but we've been around here for a long time. We are the second winningest team in this decade. We played the same schedule that we played last year, except we swapped Duke for North Carolina. I think the biggest thing is sometimes people create storylines in the offseason, and sometimes it doesn't add up. You know, we weren't supposed to be very good on defense last year. Last year, we had all those superstar guys, and we were portrayed differently. The crazy thing is, this year's team is better than last year's team, and it's really not even close. But yet, you would think, based on the perception, because they still talk about a close game at North Carolina, they still talk about Trevor throwing a few interceptions early in the season, they don't talk about all the touchdowns. Trevor, if they thought he was good last year, he's so much better now than he was last year at any point. He's twice the quarterback he is now. And he was during the national championship game when everyone crowned him the king of football. He's twice the quarterback he is today. And people have missed it because of this rhetoric all year." It goes on and on and on. And I mean, I sat here and I'm reading it. I'm like, yep, exactly. Yep, exactly. Because we let sports media influence us. Clemson did not look good early in the year. They did not on offense. They did not look good on offense early in the year because they were giving Trevor Lawrence the challenges he needed and the freedoms he needed to become twice the quarterback he was last year. And guess what? He is. It worked. If anyone doesn't fear Clemson right now, if anyone thinks that Clemson is not one of the top 2 teams in the country because they played, what, Virginia? Virginia Tech? I don't know. Why? Because they played Syracuse? I watched the film. They're one of the best 2 teams in the country. And everyone should be a little nervous to play in the Tigers out of Clemson, South Carolina. And he also goes on and he's taking shots at the media, taking shots at the SEC bias. He said, we're 10-1 against the SEC, by the way. And aren't they the best conference in the world? 6-1 against the SEC West. That don't get written, though. Shoot, that don't fit. Trevor threw an interception. Let's put that on a loop. This team has not been accurately portrayed by a lot of people. They don't pay attention. And they just believe what they're told. They don't watch the tape. Amen, Dabo Swinney. Most of these sons of bitches in sports media don't even watch a snap of film. Even if they knew how to watch it or what they were watching, they don't do it. And if they do, it doesn't matter. Most of them don't have a clue. I had to bring that up because he spoke to my soul of what I watch, what I see. And Joshua Perry and I talked about it. It's like people don't even watch the film. So Clemson's really good. Let's just make sure that's clear. I want to make sure that's out there. Clemson is really, really, really good. Them and Ohio State are the 2 best teams in the country. LSU has a great offense, a very average defense, so they're 3rd, and you could put whoever you want at 4th. Probably Utah. That's really not even, I don't even know who, maybe Oklahoma, but either way, those 2 teams are not as good as the other 3. But it's Ohio State and Clemson right now. Anybody can win a game, but those 2 are the best 2 teams in the country. Write it down. But I didn't get to it. I want to save it for tomorrow's episode. We'll talk about the conference breakdowns when we talk about the conference championship games. And I do want to mention one more thing before we close. I've seen a lot of people this week praising Urban Meyer and giving him credit for this Ohio State team. And I certainly don't want to discredit his impact on this team, but let us not forget, Urban Meyer would never have fired Greg Schiano. Urban Meyer would not fire Ed Warner after 2015. He actually hired him, which was a big mistake. Ryan Day walked in the door fired the defensive coaches that he felt needed to be let go, ones that he viewed were a part of the problem, and he fixed the shit, something Urban did not ever really do. Because Urban hated confrontation, didn't like to rock the boat, certainly didn't want to fire his buddy, Schiano. So Urban definitely has a major, major play in the success of Ohio State, but let's not forget how important Ryan Day has been to this Ohio State team. But that's all we got for you today. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you were entertained. Make sure if you're interested in sponsorship and advertising, reach out Zach, Z-A-C-H, at Menace2SocietyPodcast.com. Stay tuned in the coming week for some major changes with our platform, growth, some expansion, and also we're planning a new event for the playoffs, trying to figure out if we're going to go to the playoffs or if we're going to have a watch party here in Columbus. But either way, stay tuned. More info to come, probably Monday. Appreciate you listening. Appreciate you tuning in. Thank you, everyone, for supporting this movement. If you liked it, thank you very much. If you didn't, as we say, go fuck yourself, San Diego.
That's why I don't read the newspaper, because it's garbage. And the editor that let it come out is garbage.
Or do you do what everybody else in media does, just create some shit and throw it on the wall and see what sticks, which is what I see happening everywhere.
Where are we at in society today? I'm a man. I'm 40.
When my time on Earth is gone and my activities here are past, I want they bury me upside down and my critics can kiss my ass.